Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Anthony McCusker, an attorney of more than 20 years here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Anthony's worked with and represented companies like Slack, Lyft, Atlassian, and more throughout his career. Today, we're talking all about the legalities of starting a side hustle. Can you do it? Under what circumstances? What are the common pitfalls you need to avoid? Which of your employment agreements do you need to go through with a fine-tooth comb? Should you tell your boss about your side project? And so much more. Before we get started, though, a quick heads up. Anthony and I could only talk over the phone, so the audio quality is less than we're used to here on the show. But I made the call to run this interview in its entirety because the content is incredibly valuable. We cover questions and scenarios that would have saved me and a lot of other people I know a ton of time, money, and countless hours of lost sleep during my side hustle days. I can promise you this interview is worth its weight in gold, so let's get straight to it. And as always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Anthony McCusker.
Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I've got a warm-up question for you. What book are you reading right now, or what has been your favorite recently?
I just completed a book called A Gentleman in Moscow, which is an amazing story and a great read.
What's it about?
It is about a former count who, when Russia fell in the early 1920s, was convicted of being royalty, basically, and assigned to house arrest in a hotel for the rest of his life.
Oh, gosh.
He basically lives out like the next 30 or 40 years during the novel, never setting foot outside of this hotel.
Whoa. Okay, yeah. I'm adding that to my list to check out.
Yeah, it's a cool book.
All right, so you've been a practicing attorney for more than 20 years, working largely with tech companies of all shapes and sizes from what I can see. Can you tell us about what your work looks like these days?
Sure. And so that's right, and I feel pretty fortunate that the way I've been able to structure my career is to have the ability to work with, you know, companies of all sizes, from a couple of founders with an idea even before they've incorporated their company through public offering and beyond, and kind of everything in between, whether it's, you know, financing work or corporate governance or mergers on the buy side or the sell side, or, you know, public offerings and then the general corporate public company stuff that you do after a company is public. And kind of the key for me, the key driver of all of those things is sort of working with entrepreneurs and executives that are actually doing really cool things and helping them, you know, meet their business goals in a small way by, you know, guiding them through the legal piece of it and the judgment and the counseling that goes, you know, kind of every step of the way. That's probably about 80% of my practice, and then the other 20%, 20-25%, I guess, is working with investors. So I work with a bunch of venture firms, representing them when they make investments into companies like the ones I represent.
So who are some of the companies you've worked with or are currently working with?
Sure. So I currently had a few public offerings recently in the last couple of years with a company called Atlassian, Twilio, Okta. I've taken those three companies public in the last couple years. I served as underwriter at counsel representing the underwriting syndicate in the recent Snap deal. I represent a bunch of really great still privately held companies as well, like Eventbrite and Quora and Qualtrics, among others. It's just a little sampling.
Yeah. What's been, say, your favorite company, or I guess framing it from a product standpoint, what's been the coolest sort of product you've gotten to work with and see the founders grow?
You know, there's a ton of really great stories that you know, I sort of could call upon. I think one that's a little bit in the past, I was fortunate to work with a company that made the Flip video camera, which a lot of people may not even remember, but that was a fascinating company to work with for a bunch of years. It was ultimately sold to Cisco before the iPhone had a forward-facing camera. But it was a company that had started off as a single-use digital camera that would be sort of recycled, and people would get, you know, back in the olden days, people would get an email with the photos they had taken. They sort of figured that that business was probably not going to have legs, even though it had raised a lot of money and had done pretty well. And they pivoted into making this video camera that became wildly successful and was ultimately sold. And really, you know, like, I have a lot of stories about companies that have done some cool stuff and have done, you know, amazing products. And I work with, you know, a lot of companies that actually have really great products. But that was an interesting story and one that stands out just because of the way to sort of pivot and have, in the history of a really fast-changing set of technologies, two really interesting products that one private company created. And then, interestingly, neither of which really exist today because technology just moves so fast. I think it's just it's a really kind of interesting story about how quickly things move and the nimbleness of that management team that was required to make something good once the technology had moved past where they had originally started and developed something great. But ultimately that product was, you know, superseded by phones that everyone carries that have video and camera capabilities now too, right?
Right. So one thing I know I really wanted to dig into with you today was sort of on the front end of that with the entrepreneurs. So a lot of our listeners here today are starting side hustles or have side hustles of their own they're already working on. And going back to kind of just first things first, is it legal for people to have a side hustle while they hold on to their full-time job?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It's actually one that I think is really helpful for your listeners to sort of understand, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty around it for people. And the short answer is yes, it's legal within some bounds, right? And so every jurisdiction's a little different. In California, and I can kind of speak to California, which is where we live and where we practice, but every jurisdiction's basically got a variation on this, and that is, as employees, especially in the technology space, if your listeners are working in the technology space, they have an employment agreement or an offer letter, and they work for a company, and they have, you know, kind of a duty as an employee or as an officer, if they're actually an officer of their company, not to compete with that company. And you have sort of, you know, kind of these moral duties, fiduciary duties at the officer level to not be competing with your existing employer as you're getting paid. And courts will uphold that and observe that, and that's, you know, sort of appropriate and fair. And you also have, in most companies, you have, when you become employed, you sign something called a proprietary information and inventions agreement that basically says, hey, look, while you work here, we own the things that you build that are created to, you know, kind of related to our business. And so, kind of as a threshold question, people that have side hustles need to think about, you know, hey, am I doing something that's competitive or something that's related to my, you know, day in and day out work at my employer, right? And if the answer is we can talk about yes and no to that answer. If the answer is no, that's sort of, you know, I guess better and easier. Because if the answer is no, that means that things that you build that are unrelated, as long as you do it on your own time, using your own equipment, right? It's kind of what, you know, people sort of refer to as kind of like nights and weekend type work, right? If you're doing that, you know, nights and weekends, not using your own equipment, that is totally fair and it's legal and you can go do that. And it's how most companies actually get their start, right? That most people don't quit their job and start something the next day, right? They are working on some ideas and building things on their own as they're doing it. And if it's unrelated and you're doing it nights and weekends with your own equipment, you know, that's totally cool and legal, et cetera. Where people get into, you know, kind of a grayer area, is if they're starting to do something that's, you know, that's competitive or is related, maybe not even competitive, but related to the types of things they're doing at their day job. And even in that area, if you're doing it kind of nights and weekends and on your own equipment, you know, that's risky, frankly, because, you know, you probably have a proprietary information inventions agreement that says, hey, the things you do that are related to this business are ours. And, you know, it's not black and white. You know, people will say, hey, look, I went home, I turned on my own personal computer, and I worked on, you know, this sort of related idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you may, like, you may ultimately be able to succeed with that argument. The real problem is for someone starting a young business is just a lack of resources to go fight that if you have to go fight it and to prove it out that, no, in fact, you know, I used nothing related to what I had learned or used in my day job. I used my own equipment. And, yeah, sure, like, you know, I'm a programmer and I wrote, you know, kind of a, you know, kind of an adjacent set of technologies, but, you know, it was unrelated. Like, yeah, you may be right, but your ability to win that argument and see that fight through and get funded in the face of a letter from your prior employer that says, hey, we think you ripped our IP off, is a real challenge. And so I think that for people that are going to do something that's in a similar space or an adjacent space or something that's competitive, you really would be well advised to kind of think long and hard before getting too far with your idea and your nights and weekends sort of work while you're still employed. And then there's like a third category of people that are like holding down two jobs. And that is like, you know, in the real world, lots of people have, you know, multiple jobs. People make ends meet. The two jobs, the two IP related jobs gets really tricky for those companies when people are trying to figure out, hey, like, who owns what, right? And frankly, most of the time, none of that ever comes to the forefront. But if you actually had to go and untangle that, that becomes kind of a mess. And these issues have gotten trickier over time because, you know, in the 1970s, it might have been easier to figure out what nights and weekends meant. And I think, you know, today people work kind of around the clock and they work from remote locations and they work from home and they work on the weekends just as much as they do during the day or at night. And so it's sometimes hard to decide what's, you know, what is a night and weekend any longer. And so I think for the people in that first category doing something, you know, kind of unrelated or separate, with their own equipment, and you know, I think it behooves you as like a best practice to sort of, you know, document that and to make sure that you're keeping a log of what you're doing and when you're doing it, so that you can actually, you know, show that to a potential investor that was like, hey, you've been working for 6 months on this side job. Like, what is your, you know, what is the state of your IP and the ownership of it, et cetera, right? I think you want to be really careful in documenting it because there's almost nothing that can kill a young company faster than some of those mistakes. I'll pause there, Ryan, because there might be some stuff you want to drill into on that.
Yeah. How do you recommend people document their work like that? So do you say, like, you know, use a time tracking app, like a project management app on your computer, like something where you like physically log in and it, you know, maybe pulls your IP address to show you're at home or something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, people, you know, I think sort of some people use that. I think that like consistency is sort of what I'd recommend there, right? I think that it's, if you're, you know, a lot of people will find it easier just to keep a logbook, right? You know, write it down. It's not as, you know, foolproof in terms of, you know, like Discovery is like some software that tracked it electronically for you and is an independent data source for it. But, you know, people's own logbook engineers have been doing that, you know, over the course of time. And, you know, it's a tried and true way to sort of understand what you're working on and when you did it. And frankly, if there's ever dispute, you can attest to, hey, yeah, this is accurate. And sometimes, you know, the consistency of a logbook might be better than someone, you know, having to remember to go back and, you know, log on to their, you know, some software that's going to track it for them. But I think some method of that is, you know, is useful and helpful. And I think probably most clients that we've seen do this, probably it's a little more manual, which is maybe surprising, but I think a little, you know, people tend to do it a little more manually.
Yeah. So how about that group of people, the second group of people you were talking about? So someone who is, say, already working on a side project, for sake of argument, and they don't think they're really violating their non-compete agreements or their IP agreements with their employer, but maybe there's some gray area there. It's somehow related, at least in some small way, to what they do at their day job. What do you recommend to someone who's in that position today?
Yeah, they're in a tricky spot because, you know, I think that the easy answer is, hey, go to your boss and, you know, profess what you've done and what you're working on and ask them to bless it. And, you know, most companies are just sort of like, hey, you know, we're okay with you spending time doing your own thing on nights and weekends, and a lot of our people are going to start companies, and we support entrepreneurialism, et cetera, right? But, you know, we're not gonna sign something for you. And so you sort of end up, I've seen people end up in a tricky spot where they've gone and sort of, you know, bared their soul to their boss, but they don't get any benefit from it other than they've alerted to someone that when they leave, they're probably doing something that is, you know, at least in their mind at one point was questionable around whether they, you know, were fully clean. You know, I think that, you know, at some point, you probably have to make a decision on whether your side gig is a viable, you know, standalone business and make decisions around what you can do and continue to do while you're continuing to work, right? And I think that it's not the best legal advice you could ever, like, give or receive, but, you know, perfect is a little bit the enemy of good on that, right? And I think that you have to keep your job and pay your bills and do all of those things, but at some point, you know, you're probably going to get to the place where you're like, hey, this has probably become, you know, close enough where I'm uncomfortable continuing to develop independent IP and hope that I own it.
Mm-hmm.
And can defend that I own it against someone else.
So let's say some of our listeners today haven't gotten started yet. When they're thinking of getting started on their idea, they're pulling their employment contracts, they're looking for any sort of, you know, conflicts of interest or specific agreements that would get them into hot water. What point should they sort of maybe contact an attorney if they're unsure about something? And then equally as important, at what point should they bring it up with their boss, or should they?
Yeah. So, you know, and it raises one really good question that a lot of people aren't aware of, is when you start a new job, you know, if you have an idea, even if it's fairly nascent and you haven't really built it out, you know, when you sign your proprietary information inventions agreement, there's always a section called excluded inventions. And if you have an idea that you've actually either been working on for some period of time or is even just a nascent kernel of an idea, when you start your new job, if you actually say, hey, look, I'm working on XYZ independently, I've been working on it for, you know, X days or X years, and it's like my side idea, I'm excluding that idea and the work around it from the assignment invention that I'm giving to you as an employee. And so if you were to do that, you know, and that's like kind of the gold standard, right? Because now you've excluded everything that relates to your new idea as you go into your employment. You know, it's harder to go to someone as an existing business and say, hey, look, you know, it might be a little related, but I hope to amend my proprietary information inventions agreement to list this thing, right? Most employers are, you know, not excited about that prospect, and so they'd say, hey, look, you know, that's not something we do here, and they're probably right that most companies don't actually do that. But it is one approach, right? You could say, hey, look, I need to add an invention that I'm working on, you know, nights and weekends on the side that's, you know, unrelated to your business or isn't directly related to the work I do each day, and I want to exclude that, and that, like, I'm going to continue to work here, that, like, my condition to continue to work is that I have clear ownership of that product or that IP. You know, not very many people go have that conversation. Frankly, most people say, you know, hey, I'm just going to manage this for as long as I can, and then when I think that this is a viable business, I'm going to move off and just go do my own thing. And if I do that, you know, kind of early enough in the development of my side business, it's probably okay. And in most instances, it probably is okay, frankly, right? It's just that most people are uncomfortable or don't have the leverage or the standing within their business to be able to go to their existing employer and say, hey, I want to list this as something that's, you know, mine and not yours, regardless of what happens in the future. Most companies just don't entertain those discussions.
Right. Have you ever worked with a client company that's gone through either, you know, litigation or maybe even just like cease and desist kinds of conversations with an employee who's operating a side business?
Yeah, you know, so the standard, like the reality is that, it's people sort of end up just saying, hey, I'm going to do my own thing for as long as I think I possibly can, and then I'm going to go off and do it, you know, as a separate business, and I'm just going to manage that risk. And people, you know, really kind of, as we've been describing, do that because that's kind of the practical right thing to do. But it also turns out that it's probably, you know, the successful approach as well, right? Because what usually happens is, and there's lots of instances where someone goes off and does something, and there's kind of a culture within companies, right? And you know, the better cultures are usually like, hey, we want our people to grow and develop, and we hope they do it here. But if they go do it somewhere else, as long as they're not stealing our IP, we're going to be, you know, we're going to root them on in the sidelines. And, you know, when people, you know, go do that, if someone rips off IP, there's going to be a big, giant mess. If someone is just susceptible, like, hey, look, this new site, it looks a little similar to what we're doing. Most companies don't get too excited about that. What gets them excited is when employees 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 all leave and follow their old buddy to go start this business. And whether they think you've ripped them off or whether they just think you're soliciting their employees, you'll probably get a letter at some point saying, hey, we're kind of watching what we do, what you're doing. We hope you're, you know, complying with your contractual obligations around IP ownership. And, you know, we better not be soliciting our people. And usually, if you get that letter, and, you know, probably somewhere north of 90% of the letters like that are written, a nice response comes back that says, hey, we're well aware of our legal obligations. We take them seriously, including around intellectual property. And by the way, we didn't solicit these employees, you know, love former employer or employee. And that's the last you hear of it in like, you know, 80, 90% of those situations. You don't hear anything more about it. And it's really only the scenarios where they really do feel that they've been wronged around IP, you know, that those things take on a life of their own and lead to litigation or an elevated sense of letter writing campaign.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny you mention that because I actually had a similar experience with my very first job out of school. Is I began working on a little side project at the time that I personally didn't feel was related to the business that I was working for. And you know, a couple months after I had started working on this project, I actually got another job. So I moved companies, but I was keeping this side project going. And my old bosses from that first company eventually stumbled upon my website because I was, of course, Facebook friends with them. and I got a really sort of threatening cease and desist email from them eventually for something that, I mean, I felt like there was no crossover, but, you know, what one takeaway for me that was really interesting was that despite me not feeling there was crossover, it was a potential business area that they had wanted to think about going in the direction and chasing themselves, and I had no idea.
Yep. Yeah, and that is one of the, you know, that's one of the, you know, the tricky parts in this space is that, like, everything you do is measured and viewed with 20/20 hindsight, right? So, you know, not only do people look back, oh, well, look what happened, right? Like, yeah, this, you know, 2 years ago when you started your side business, you know, no one would have thought it was related. And then two things kind of pivot or deviate into a different direction, or the world moves in a different direction. And then they look like they're a little closer 2 years later than they did, you know, at some point earlier in time. And there's the piece that you experienced where it's like, hey, there was guys in a side room having conversations on where they wanted to take the business that they hadn't been transparent with the rest of the organization around. And you had no idea that, like, you were three steps down the roadmap of where they thought they were going. And when they saw that you were already there, it was like, hey, like, how do you know that we got the, how'd he get there without knowing, you know, kind of the interim steps that we were actually working on with him. And that's, you know, that's a, yeah, that happens, right? And that's mm-hmm. that's part of the reason why it's like, hey, once you decide you've got something viable, if it's close enough, right? And you know, in a lot of ways, everything's close, right? Like you have a skill set and a set of things that you're really good at, and that's why you're getting paid to do them, right? And so when you're starting something on the side, you know, when you're at a five-person company, yeah, it feels worlds away. When that five-person company becomes a 150-person company, they're able to do a lot more things that may sort of encompass the stuff that that you've been working on in your living room for the last year and a half, right?
Mm-hmm. So, Anthony, this is my last question for you. Do you have any particular resources, you know, books, websites, you know, tools, anything that someone should head to and learn more about around the legality of their side hustle?
Yeah, you know, the and kind of to answer the question, one of the other questions, you know, when should you talk to people, you know, lawyers? You know, I do think most lawyers that do a technology practice, you can get introduced, and I think that, the, like, they will take that call. They will help, you know, they'll talk you through it. They're not going to, hopefully, if they're good people, they're not going to say, oh, hey, I need a retainer, I need engagement. They're going to talk you through what you're doing, and you know, the hopes is that, you know, hey, you turn into a client or you turn into something, or at the very least, they're kind of paying it forward and helping someone that's trying to do something entrepreneurial. And so I do think that's, you know, like, you shouldn't hesitate to get advice, because you will get, you know, good, you know, free consult, and it, that'll help you make your decision. You know, I think that there are some resources out there. You know, we have, our firm has something called foundersworkbench.com that has a bunch of different articles and resources. The tricky part of this is it's pretty fact specific, right? It's like, what are you working on? What are you doing? And it really is going to come down to, and what have you signed? And it's going to come down to some of those scenarios where, for this kind of stuff, I actually think of talking to, you know, friends or referrals that have actually either been through it or are lawyers in this space is probably, you know, your quickest and best resource, because there are only, you know, there's only a handful of things that people need to understand, but depending on how it, you know, how it plays out, you're going to want that, you're going to want that kind of fact-specific advice that you may not find in an article. And then, like, one more thing, if I could, Ryan, like the,
sure.
You know, people talk about, like, equipment and one of the sets of cases that you're seeing out in the world is called, like, IP mobility, and that is this idea of, like, taking an idea and working on it and then moving it to a new employer. And, you know, people say, oh, hey, well, I used my own laptop. Great. I used my own phone. Great. You know, those are, like, obvious. Some of the new technology platforms, things like Dropbox, Box, Evernote, other things, people should be thoughtful about how they use those and setting up separate accounts, because there's lots of examples of the world of people in the world of people that I think are actually probably dead, done no wrong and got caught up in a competitive situation, or maybe something like you described in your own personal situation. And they get a letter, and now they're working at their new employer, or they've started their own business, and they get a letter. And so now people have to go investigate, okay, did this employee steal IP or use, you know, the former employer's, you know, work product, et cetera. And what's happening in a lot of these situations is you get your new job, you show up, you turn your new computer on at your new employer, and you go, I'm going to save this to my Dropbox account. You go in and you're working on something, you know, totally new, totally unrelated, and you open your Dropbox, and now all of a sudden everything that was in your prior Dropbox, which you may have inadvertently, you know, used on a business trip or had stored from your old employer in Dropbox that you forgot to delete, now is downloaded to the system of your new employer. And that's like tripping people up when you say, hey, we didn't take any IP. And then in discovery, they're like, well, actually, you downloaded all of these things. It was like, no, that was a totally inadvertent and totally innocent. I opened Dropbox and it just did it. Or I opened some other technology and it just did it. So people being really smart about either having a separate new service that they use on their new idea, or when they change companies, or they go back and they're actually really diligent in deleting on their last day of employment anything that was related to that prior employer, including like things that may be held in like one of those other services, because it's just something people don't think about and is totally innocent, but is something that can actually trip people up and then becomes a hook into, you know, kind of a you know, a phishing campaign about what else might exist.
That's great advice. Well, Anthony, thank you again for being on the show. Can you tell our listeners today where they can head to learn more about you and Goodwin and everything you guys are up to?
Yeah, sure. Our website's Goodwin Law, G-O-O-D-W-I-N, law.com.
All right. Awesome. Thank you again.
Cool. Thanks, Ryan.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.